Hi, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. Welcome to Letting Go with Guy Finley. Guy is the best-selling author of Let Go and Live in the Now, and is the founding director of nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. And now, here's Guy Finley.
The greatest things in the world aren't things at all. What is great, what is good, what is enduring is wisdom. And the reason that wisdom is great and true and good is because wisdom is the perfect catalyst, the perfect alchemical element, the perfect cauldron for anything that is brought into it, or anything that it brings itself to is instantaneously made into the goodness and the trueness and the rightness of that wisdom itself. And there is no substitute for this. You can search as you have, and you can come up with the things that you have found and put on the altars in your life, but they will always decay and they will always betray, because that's the nature of all things that are not part of what is eternal and good. I am sometimes, when I sit here and get ready to speak, at a loss in a way, because what I want to bring to you is something not dissimilar to a man who has stumbled upon the Victoria Falls. Do you know what the Victoria Falls are? 7 mile wide, beautiful stretch of falls. These Victoria Falls, more energy, more water than can possibly even be held in a glimpse of it, let alone carried back and spoken to and about to other men and women. But that's the nature of our difficulty, and also the nature of our gift, our ability as men and women to find in ourselves a living waterfall, a source of power and truth and rightness that requires nothing outside of itself to say it's good. It doesn't need the approval of anyone in order to know that it's true, but that lives in itself and for itself for all time. And that's a difficult thing to convey in words to people. And so the challenge is for you and I, when we sit and have a talk like this, is to understand that just to hear something is only a tiny fraction of a possibility of a person discovering a potential within himself or herself, of not being a set of ears and a sense of set of sensations that feel good about some wonderful true ideas and the spirit that comes with it, but to find it for themselves in themselves. A quick story came to my mind just right before we started, trying to come up with a way to get across that idea of what's required of a man or woman who wants to have a living relationship with wisdom. And what came to mind was that here comes this, a naturalist. She's been an explorer of remote regions for her whole lifetime, and she teaches, let's say, at a major university, and she just gets back off the plane in time to address this huge congregation of people who had come to hear her talk about the new discovery she'd made. And so she talked about this place that was difficult to get to, wild animals, you know, terrible, ferocious conditions, but that at the heart of this small valley that was sitting at the top of a mountain, she found a flower. And the flower, she said, just to brew a tea from it, if you will, just to look at it, whatever, had a healing, miraculous healing effect, that even though, she said, I could tell you about it to the people, you can't know from yourself what has transpired, what has been transformed in me for this. And she spoke eloquently of it and was able to elicit marvelous points and proving in some respect the existence of it, even though it couldn't be proven as a thing because it was being discussed as an ideal. And out of the, let's say, 10,000 people who gathered there to hear her speak, a year later, 9,999 of those people were exactly the same. No, actually not exactly the same, worse. Because you either get better or you don't. There is no static quality in life, I assure you. Only one out of the 9,999 actually made the journey. And when that person came to see her, she knew instantly that they had. She said, I'm just curious, although I suspect the reason why did you make the journey and 9,999 didn't. And the man that was standing there, the young man, said, he said, because after the talk, he said, I was so caught up in what you were talking about, and I sensed the truth of it, that I came up to speak to you. Do you remember? She said, yes, I did. And he said, and it was then, he said, that I caught the scent of the flower on your clothes. That's what we meet for. So you can catch the scent of something. And in catching the scent of it, recognize that there is something that you have touched, heard, felt, that is beyond your present understanding, but that yet must be within your understanding. Otherwise, you couldn't have smelled what you smelled. Now, that's the problem, but also the beauty of it, isn't it? So, take a deep breath now that I've spent 7 minutes setting up what I have to set up. There's a lot of pain and confusion in life, isn't there? Conditions change. Things that we held true, that we valued, that we believed were essential, that had a sense of security in them for us, they start to shake. And lo and behold, as the things that we were holding on to for our sense of self begin to shake, we too begin to shake. And the more we shake, the more we seek ways not to. And out of those ways of avoiding the pain that's come with things dissolving in front of us, comes all of the ways in which we further distract ourselves, not in understanding the inherent underlying shakiness of our present life, but instead trying to find ways to make what is shaky not shaky, in finding more things that eventually shake. This is the human condition. And all of that can be understood. Not only understood, meaning that the very pursuit of the things that a person pursues that prove themselves pointless over and over and over again, It can be so understood that a person is literally, for the understanding of the whole of that, that person is literally transported. They're literally transported to another world, even though they sit in the same body, look out of the same, well, no, actually, they don't look out of the same eyes. The same eyes hold a new seer, and the new seer understands in totality the relationship between the individual's life and the world around him or her, so much so that they're no longer capable of being carried away by the things that ordinarily in the past carried them away and led them off to a punishment. So I'm going to tell you a story now to help just put the scent of something celestial in the air. Then we'll explain it a little bit. There was once a man, a father, and he had a daughter, a young daughter, that he loved very much. And he wanted more than anything for his daughter to begin to catch the scent, if you will, of certain things that in his life, due to grace and effort on his part, he had caught the scent of. And he wanted at the beginning, if it was possible for her, to understand that the world that she took to be the only world wasn't the only world. But how do you convey that, especially to a child? But he had an idea and he hoped it would work out, so he took his daughter on a camping trip. For one thing, he knew it was essential to get her out so that she could see things at a distance. I can't tell you how important it is to see things at a distance. You don't know what a little world you live in. Even if those of you who live in nature, all you see is your thoughts, which we'll talk about. So, father takes daughter to the camping trip and brings her deliberately after a large storm to a place where there was a kind of campsite by a large river. He'd waited for the storm purposefully, and you'll understand this as I explain it. And they made their campsite there by the river, and he went about his business doing what he was doing, knowing that his little girl would be attracted to the river. Human beings are naturally attracted to rivers, great bodies of water. They're naturally attracted, and you'll understand why more too. So knowing his daughter would go down to the river, he went about doing what he was doing, keeping a close eye on her. And as he watched, sure enough, he began to notice that first she'd be watching something upriver, so to speak, and then she'd watch it come down, and then she'd watch it go past. And then she'd sit there and think for a second, and then she'd start looking again. And after a storm, you know, trees and bushes and all kinds of things just coming down the river. And within about 10 minutes, his little girl's demeanor that had been quite delightful prior to her sitting by the river had started to turn slightly dour, slightly sour. And he walked up to his daughter and said, "What's wrong, sweetheart?" And like all human beings, she didn't know what was wrong. There was just something wrong. But he knew what was wrong. He knew what the source of her unhappiness was. And he said, well, do you want to talk at all about it? She said, she really couldn't speak of it. He said, okay, come here, I want to show you something. And father took daughter, and they got in their car, and they drove for about 10 minutes to the top of a small mountain that sat there where that valley and river was at its foot. And he took her up to the top of that hill there, and they sat, the two of them, there. And he said, look, sweetheart, and he pointed to the river that went all the way in the distance to one direction till it was out of sight. And then he pointed down the other side of the river all the way in the distance till it went out of sight. And he said to her, one day you'll understand that there's more to the river than what moves through it. One day you'll understand that there's more to the river than its movement. She didn't understand. How could she understand something like that? I dare say, I wonder if you can understand it. But through the years, as she grew up, she began to actually understand what her father had been trying to teach her, which we're now going to look at for ourselves. So take another deep breath, because we have some pretty interesting things to do. The first important thing that a person not just understand with their mind, but begin to actually recognize as being true, is that our experience of life, what we take from it, our experience of life is a direct product of our perception. We receive absolutely, moment to moment to moment, what we perceive.
Love, the brightest and most powerful force in the universe. Love melts stress and cancels resentment. It gives birth to kindness and is the fuel of success. Love is at the heart of every great relationship and is the true essence of lasting peace. In his new book, Apprentice of the Heart, best-selling author Guy Finley explores lessons in life only love can teach. This breakthrough book contains the tools you need to strengthen and deepen all of your relationships with family, friends, coworkers, and with the present moment itself. Apprentice of the Heart, available now at guyfinley.com and fine bookstores everywhere. Joseph Polansky of Diamond Fire magazine writes, "The reader is lifted up to a whole new realm, a rarefied region of the soul." To order your copy of Guy Finley's Apprentice of the Heart, visit guyfinley.com. That's guyfinley.com. The relationship your heart longs for already exists.
Now, the reason it's important to understand an idea like that, that we ourselves are all the time receiving, if you will, the product of our perception, is because it isn't until we understand the relationship between what we see and how we see it that we begin to understand, far more important than the things that we see is the nature of the thing in us that does the seeing. Far more important than what we behold is the one who beholds. Because until we understand that our experience, the whole of the quality of our life, the essence of it, moment to moment, is a product of that nature in us that sees things, instead of thinking that if we could change what we see, we'd be happy, we're never going to find that flower. We're never going to find the peace. We're never going to find the contentment that we want. Why? Why did the little girl have trouble with the river? Because things were up there. She's looking. Oh, what's that? Oh, look at that tree. Wait. No. Whoa. Whoa. Don't go, tree. Oh, look. There's a squirrel on a trunk of something. I love squirrels. Oh, squirrels. No, wait. No, squirrel. Don't go. Our mind is all the time caught up in movement. It is all the time identified with movement. And anything that we are identified with that moves is going to move away, because it is the nature of what moves to do what? Slide into the so-called past. Here it is. You look forward to it. Ever look forward to something? Oh, great. Because it's not there yet. It's much better before you have it. Then, oh, yay, look, it's coming. Here comes the squirrel on the tree. Yay, she likes me. He's going to do this. Here comes the tree. Oh, I've got it. Yeah? Look, I'm a man of substance. My face looks good today. Or whatever it would be that you hope for. And then, wait, no. No. Happiness, upriver, sadness downriver. The opposites, which is the essence of movement. No opposites, no movement. So understanding the nature of this movement, of the fact that we don't, going back to it, we don't see the whole of the river. We see what moves through it. Now, can you understand that idea? He was showing her that the river is much greater than its movement, wasn't he? All she saw was the movement that she was identified with, that she suffered from, because here comes things she likes, here comes things she doesn't like. And he was saying, look, sweetheart, there is all of that, but all of that is a minute part of the river itself. Because unbeknownst and unsaid is that the river is what? Is the river just its movement? Is the river just its movement? No, the river isn't just its movement. The river is its waters. The river is the channel through which those waters move. The river is the gravity that moves the water through that channel. And the river is the source from which it derives itself, as well as the mountaintop that receives the source in its water drop form. So here is a river whose reality is thousands of times greater than the little things that move through it on its waters. Now, the parallel here that I'm trying to get you to see is that your true nature is not the movement of thought. Your real life is not this little brain and its content called your mind that is only identified with, on a passing basis, every promise and pain that comes from the river at the top and floats out through the bottom. Now, I'm going to take a pause here. How many of you can sense what I'm talking about? This is the scent we're looking for, because it can't be spoken about. Now, there's other things you have to understand. Because no one, who sets out in life and says, you know, today I'm gonna just cause as much unhappiness for myself as I can. Today I'm going to worry, I'm going to get angry, oh boy. I'm gonna make myself sick today. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to think about someone that did something to me. I'm going to go back about 52 years and I'm just going to go through it till I get sick. Then I'm going to eat something till I get sick. Then I'm going to sleep and have nightmares. Oh boy. What a day I've got planned. Nobody does that, do they? They do, don't they? And we don't want to do that, do we? No, we don't really want to do that. We do it. I don't do the things I want to do. I do the things I don't want to do, said Paul. So we have to understand it. If we're ever going to be free, we have to understand. There has to be wisdom. But the problem is that the brain that produces this kind of bashing that it doesn't seem to have in it the wisdom we need until after we get bashed. And then the wisdom it offers us after we've been bashed really isn't wisdom at all. It's just another tree with a squirrel coming down the river. Isn't it? Isn't it? Yes, it is. So I want you to listen to this. I saw on television once a man, and he had come to a remarkable discovery. Now, the problem with great discoveries of this type is that the person who makes the great discovery doesn't even know what he's discovered, because it stops for him. But he was saying that he's found evidence now that it wasn't human beings that domesticated the wolf, but that it was actually the wolf that domesticated human beings. And then he sets out to show how it's possible. And what happened, in essence, because I have to move along now, is that when the early those early men and women sitting around the campfire, as they began to have you know, more of a place that they stayed. This is now just not hunters, but maybe hunter-gatherers and beginning of agriculture. That these wolves came around the campfires, their homes, and they would throw scraps of food to the wolves for several reasons. But the point being that little by little, as the wolves became more tolerant, more friendly, and came closer and closer and closer, the human beings recognized that if they had the wolves close to camp, And the wolves began to think that the camp was their home, that then when the saber-toothed tiger or the woolly mammoth or anything else that was unseemly in those days, and God knows there was lots of unseemly stuff, that when anything came around, that the wolves would then protect them. Hence the dog and barking and protection. Now, what did that do for the human beings? Well, you see, that allowed the human beings to drink more. You get what I'm saying. In other words, I don't need to worry about what's out there right now. I can have another cup of that cactus juice. I can let my mind worry about other things, like how to get more food, how to make better tools, because I don't have to worry so much about the creatures. Now my consciousness is somewhat freed to pursue other ends. And so the dog, if you will, the wolf, becoming part of the life, allowed the brain of the human being to produce a bit of its own evolution, an evolution that was inherent in its own thought progress and process, but that couldn't take place without a factor outside of it. Now, we have to go further than this. We've also found of late, and I can assure you that it's true, and I'll ask you, did your eye develop the light that it sees, or is the light that we see what developed our eye as it is? The fact is that it's the light that develops the eye. They know that earlier hominids did not perceive as many colors as we do. And that something in the spectrum of light, which, by the way, is continually changing and evolving as we move closer to the center of our own universe, that as other spectrums of light come in, the eye itself responds to that light and begins to develop through a process of evolution the capacity to take in better and broader spectrum of light. How many of you can understand that? Now, if that's true, and it is, that our eyes didn't develop light, but light developed our eyes, here's the key point. So is it true that it is not our brain that develops thought. It is thought that has developed our brain. And if you can understand inside of that idea, that means that, well, let's take an example. Here I am, and I've got more time around the campfire now to do what? To add things to myself. In essence, to become less a sensory creature and more a materialistic creature. I can pursue ends that give me a greater sense of security. And so the mind, seeking greater sense of security, begins to perceive that what that mind must do is somehow obtain or produce things outside of itself so that it has security. Now, that's natural in a certain way. You want to have enough beans for the week. Do you understand what I'm saying? You want to learn how to salt a salmon if that's what it takes. These things are necessary, but little by little that same mind begins to believe that security is not something that has to do with things outside, but that which it can identify with inside of itself that gives it itself a sense of itself and being secure. And so that brain, through thought, begins to do what? It begins to think about ways in order to bring itself what itself sees is missing. But the seer at that point is no longer the human being, but thought that's measuring what it has against what it could have. Now, that means that the brain itself, just like the eye that was developed by the light, the brain itself, the mind itself, begins to be formed in order to be able to process and produce higher forms of thought. And our brain today is a vessel for the thoughts and the kind of thinking that allows us to be human beings who are more capable of imagining life than are capable of living it. And all of the development relative to I'm talking about the actual brain itself. And the key here to understand is that that brain and those thoughts, the way we are now, they have their own life. And if you can understand what I'm saying, that the evolution of the brain through thought cannot bring about what thought produces in the end, which is the pain that comes with being identified with its own movement. If you could just understand that one thing. I'm sorry that sometimes sentences have to have 42 words in them. I am. But that's how it comes. What I'm saying to you is that the way you are now, the way you think, your present nature is a captive of the way in which you think and see. Because, next important point, what you see is the way you think. I said that you receive what you perceive. What you see now is the way you think towards things. You don't see what is, you see your thoughts about what is. And the thoughts that give you what you see themselves belong to an inherently limited machine. Something that is set into motion by itself for the purpose of securing itself through things which are imagined. That means this is a way of getting to this idea of the circle of self. You know, I talk about the circle of self. I'm describing to you the circle of self. I'm describing to you a mind that in its own activity that has been developed by Desire producing thought, thought producing desire, producing an end to its unhappiness, does not produce the end to its unhappiness, but merely seeds the unhappiness again in a different form in itself in time. You know, there was a point where a man thought, God, if I just had a jug. You know, if I had a jug, God, I'd have it all. I could carry water from the stream back to the house. My wife wouldn't yell at me. She'd have not water on tap, but had something like that. Then you know what happens after you need a jug. God, if I just had a cart, I got this mule. I could put the jug in the cart. I'd get it there faster, happier home. Then after that, what? Now the brain's still working, isn't it? Carriage. Then when it's raining, I won't get wet. Then she won't yell at me for a wet floor. It isn't men who developed the world. It was the fear of women. Well, you see, that's in it, isn't it? Isn't it? Fear of one another. And then ways to become stronger, better looking, so that someone will depend upon me, so they'll be afraid of me. All the things, the social graces that one seems to try to acquire in the form of powers and possessions, all for the purpose of being able to rule something that's changing even as they're trying to rule it.
You're listening to Letting Go with Guy Finley. For more information about Guy's life-empowering ideas, visit GuyFinley.com. We'll be back in a moment.
One reason the wind of good fortune is often found at the back of people who are successful in life is because these individuals are usually found moving ahead of it in anticipation of its arrival. Hi, this is Dr. Ellen Dickstein. The engaging words of best-selling author Guy Finley remind us that real success in life is a relationship between ourselves and a timeless greatness that lives within us. Each week, you can receive a powerful, life-affirming message from Guy, guaranteed to help you succeed with your wish for a new life. Each brief, uplifting insight reminds you that nothing can stop you from knowing the higher happiness your heart longs for. To receive Guy Finley's free weekly key lessons, just visit GuyFinley.com. Join the thousands of grateful individuals who are learning how to make themselves and our world a better place. Visit GuyFinley.com. That's GuyFinley.com.
Welcome back to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley.
Now, if you've understood this important point, and I hope that you have, about how we are all the time captive of something without understanding it, it begs the question, if that's so, where's out? Where's freedom? It begs the question, where's freedom? If right now what I take as being the path to freedom isn't the path to freedom at all, but the promise of freedom through an image that my mind has produced that turns out to be the prison when I get there, where is freedom if it's not there? We need to understand the next important point. How many of you understood so far that indeed me thinking out this life isn't going to get me out? It's not going to end the pain in it, let's put it that way. It's not going to bring a change. And it's certainly not going to allow me to have a relationship with anything higher than myself. It's impossible. Forget about all the words of God, Christ, truth, light, goodness. All those things are presently fabrications of a mind seeking freedom from its own captivity. But does that mean that the higher doesn't exist? Does that mean that God doesn't exist? Now you can, as you might, and rightly so, perhaps you can sit there and shake your head. But I would think you'd be a lot better off, instead of shaking your head, no, it doesn't prove that. I think you'd be a lot better off giving your full attention to what we're thinking about, instead of being identified even with your own states. Because what we're after here is understanding a specific quality. And that is, now take a deep breath, because it's a little bit elevated, and then we're going to go into it. Seeing, and its relationship to being. Seeing and its relationship to being. Now, first, seeing at the simplest level is a prerequisite to being. And we'll go slow now. Seeing is a prerequisite to being. How many of you ever wanted to be any kind of athlete at all? Two of you? How about an artist? Did anybody ever want to be anything? How about just happy? Here's a man. Here's a young boy. And maybe, you know, he's been out in his backyard and he's seen football players and he sees a football player and he sees, because there's a certain grace. Here's this man, he's able to move through obstacles. Or I want to be a football player, I like it. But he can't long to be the embodiment of balance, let's say. He sees an Olympic athlete on a balance bar, a gymnast. He can't long to be the embodiment of what he has seen someone else be until he has experienced the being in what he's seen. Look, when you see a gymnast or you see a Pavarotti or you see a great cellist, whatever it is that you see, don't you understand that you're not just seeing a physical action in that individual? In the moment that you look and see, for instance, I was out yesterday and these willows had all turned yellow and they'd rained their leaves on the bank over ponds. And to see the leaves, the yellow leaves on the willow and the yellow leaves on the bank and the reflection of them in the pond was a beauty that was almost too much. But the point is that the beauty that one sees out there, one can't see unless that same beauty has been stirred in a potential part of the individual's being who sees it. They are not disparate things. One gives rise to the other. And the real question is it the view that I see outside of myself that gives rise to the moment of being in that beauty, or is it the being that has the beauty in it that sees the beauty exterior to itself? That's the real question. Because in this world, they may be a requirement at the physical level. Because why? You answer this for yourself. Because where is that kind of beauty? Where is that kind of silence? I wrote a piece for this talk today. I'm going to read it quickly here. It's called Behold. Have you seen the perfect stillness of falling leaves through the air and beheld the ocean's silence as it breathes in waves there? This is not about leaves and it's not about an ocean. When you see the falling leaves of autumn, all you see, usually, if you see it at all, is the beauty of the movement. Most people don't see the beauty of the movement. They resent the movement because it means they're going to have to move and get a rake. I'll give you a moment to think about it. We get negative about things that we see if what we see isn't part of what we want to be and do in the next moment or the next day. But the falling leaves are only a fraction of what there is. They fall through something. And what they fall through is perfectly still. But we never see the perfect stillness through which things fall because our present nature is addicted to tracking things, being identified with its own comments about what falls, about its beauty, about what has to be done because the leaves have fallen. So we're forever a captive of a very limited frame of reality that is perceived by the very way in which our mind produces thoughts for the purpose of knowing itself through what it sees instead of being part of, and back to the idea that I was speaking of, instead of this completely different idea that when a person looks out, we'll go back, and they see this beauty. In that moment, this, what they see and their being have a synonymous. I don't want to use the word parallel because parallel seems to speak of something that's apart, but it's not really apart because it's one thing. But the problem with that, and please listen, is that seeing human beings have almost as a natural gift. You'd have to be a stone devil to not see the beauty of fall. But the seeing of fall leaves, the seeing of colors as they come through trees, that seeing and that awareness belong to a certain level of our being that is just as likely to see the guy in the car tailgating you and then seeing him and feeling his anxiety. Now, instead of seeing beauty, one becomes the ugliness of the individual who's tailgating him. So that at that level, what is seen and stirs our being has a certain proof to its existence and a certain necessity of our understanding the relationship between what stirs and what it stirs in us as not being disparate qualities, but a similarity of energies, one manifested in form and the other taking place in an energetic expression inside of us, that there's those worlds. But what good is that world if, even as beautiful as it may be, in this instance, let's say here, two fellows are out and you hit a bad golf shot and it goes in the pond with the leaves. Where's the beauty then? stinking golf ball, stinking fall day. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know, I love cooking. I love, oh no, he ate the last of the butter. And all of the beauty turns into bitterness. And the self in which that occurs sees not that that has happened, and merely becomes the reflection of what has been stirred in them. Now, if you can understand this essentially important idea about seeing and being, then you can also understand, or at least you should be able to, that level of seeing, that level of being aware of ourselves, has in it wonders. I mean, what's better? You go out and you see a waterfall, a huge waterfall, and you can feel you're the power of it. You're there. That power isn't just in the waterfall. That waterfall's power is pounding through you, and you're taken with it. You see a timeless sky like we talk about, and you have timelessness living in you for that moment. But that level alone, what good is it when, if you can understand it, it means that the self that is living that way is a captive of whatever it sees through its awareness, because whatever it sees, it becomes with no choice. Follow me? Because that's the nature of that movement. That's the nature of that mind, the way it works. Now, if you understand that, then you have to ask yourself a question, and I hope you will. If it takes seeing for there to be the counterpart, the expression of its being, and in the world, the best one can hope for is to see beauty, to see balance. And there's another example. You see perfect balance. You watch some marvelous athlete, whatever they're doing. Perfect balance. And then you see him throw down the club. You see him throw a football because they make a bad swing. How balanced is that? Is there any balance in anger? No. And why is the anger there? Because they're identified with the movement of thought that said, gee, what a great athlete I am. I shouldn't make mistakes. So it begs this question. If beauty, if hope, if those things that we can look out and see that allow us to experience certain levels of our own being are required for that, what happens? How will a person ever know compassion? How will a person ever know kindness or love? I want you to think about this. See, here's the problem. You think that your thoughts about being compassionate is what compassion is. Your thoughts about being compassionate have no compassion in them. And the proof of it is that if someone doesn't thank you for your compassion, that same thought that gave you the sense of self turns into an angry nature. There's resentment in our compassion. Does that beauty have ugliness in it? I don't know if you've noticed this. Gosh, even a dead tree has beauty in it if you see the beauty. But where's the beauty in an unkind act born out of someone not appreciating how kind you are? How, if I'm going to be a compassionate man, how, if I'm going to be a woman who has love that doesn't turn into any ugly opposite, how am I going to see these things in order to be them? Where shall I see them? Can I see them? This is such an important question. See, the problem is with our life, with our world, is that we have all kinds of people that we walk around and say, oh, look, a compassionate man. Oh, look, a loving woman. And he molests children. She yells at her animals when you don't see, because the act is what we believe in. We take the act of compassion, the act of being love, as the same thing as the quality of it. And the act is only the quality when the act follows the quality, not when one acts in order to make the quality seen by others for the purpose of being seen as a true human being. So it begs the question, and I hope you're following me. I'm so selfish. How many of you know yours? I'm so selfish. I'm a selfish human being. All I want to do is what? Enjoy the movement of thinking about myself. I want to think about myself. And unless you're thinking about me, I don't want to be around you, really. Now, if you want to think about me, will you marry me? As soon as you stop thinking about me, which you were only doing so I would think about you one day, I'm done. Where is it? See, you know the biggest problem with truth is? The biggest problem with truth is that you're always talking to people who think they already have it. Talking to people who think they know what compassion is. Talking to people who think they know what kindness is. I'm going to throw this in. Do you know that if you ever do something and you think to yourself, that was compassion what you just did? You were not compassionate, you were self-glorifying. real compassion, listen, has no self in it at all. Just like when you see true beauty, there's not you that sees the beauty. There is the beauty that is shared between what stirs and what is stirred. It's one thing. So to understand that, and to see the preclusion, the impossibility of coming to what it is that your heart of heart, at its deepest part, longs for, demands, if you will, because you see it clearly, it demands that you realize, I must learn what it means to participate in a completely different order of perception. I must have new eyes. Those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. Something has to transpire in me by which it makes it possible for me, listen, to see compassion.
Hear Guy Finley in person. Guy lives and teaches in Merlin, Oregon, where he speaks four times each week at beautiful nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. Visit us anytime and hear Guy's life-transforming principles in a friendly, serene, and inspiring environment. Visit GuyFinley.org or call 541-476-1200 to learn more about friendly ongoing classes. You are not alone in your quest for a new life. At Life of Learning, you'll meet others who are also seeking higher understanding, and you'll experience the power and inspiration of hearing Guy Finley in person. Plan to visit us and take the next step in your spiritual development. For information, call 541-476-1200, 541-476-1200, or visit GuyFinley.org. That's GUYFINLEY.org.
To see goodness, uncorruptibleness, to see it. But where is it? Look, how many of you know in your heart of hearts that these true and beautiful godly qualities exist? We God help us if we don't know they exist. But how many of you also begin to suspect that you're not exactly the embodiment at this point? Fact. A touch here, a taste there, a little bit, a scent here and there. And then the scent becomes a tradition, it becomes a religion, it becomes something that people worship in themselves and then cause others to act out so they can have a group of people, all of who caught a scent but never left their seat to find anything above themselves. How? Where? What does one do? And where is it? Where is that compassion? Where is that truth, that goodness that we're talking about? Here's the next deep breath, okay? First, we have to talk about where it's not. It's not in the way this present brain works, is it? It's not in thought. Absolutely not in thought. It's in stillness. That's where it is. That's where compassion is. That's where love is. That's where true sharing is. That's where love is. That's where all things good and true and eternal reside, is in stillness. Now, what a conundrum, because all I know is movement. All I know is what's coming down the river, what's in front of me, and what I just lost. What I hoped for, what I didn't get, what I should have had. Because that's how my mind works. That's the content of myself. That's the way I see. That's what I see. I don't see stillness. And I've tried all this time to show you why you don't see stillness. Do you understand what I'm trying to do? I don't see stillness because the majority of me, my present nature, abhors stillness. It wants nothing to do with what is genuinely quiet. The only time it wants what it calls quiet is when it's tracking the movement of itself, trying to get away from the pain it gave itself in all of its movement. You ever move so much you said, please don't move anymore? You understand what I'm saying? Because you wind yourself up and then finally you collapse and you go, ah, sweet, sweet peace. That's not sweet peace. That's an opposite of movement. That, by the way, you can't stay in. I don't know if you noticed that. You ever get someplace, boy, wait till I get there and I rest, and then you get there and you can't rest, not to save your life. You know why? Because your mind, your brain, it only knows to look at what moves and to derive its sense of self from it. So what about this business of stillness? Go back to our leaves. Or if we want to, we can take the turkeys that came this morning. I'm sitting there looking out the window, and here come about 22 wild turkeys to the bird feeder area. And they don't just walk in. It's like it's turkey pandemonium. They come running in like this, and then they start scratching, and here's all of this movement. Now, Let's say, how many of you like turkeys? That's because you've never had any. Let's say you like turkeys. Is it so much the turkeys that you like, or the sensation you have as you think about the turkeys on a fall day? It's the movement of that thought, isn't it? Let's say you don't like turkeys because they're a mess. What is it you don't like about turkeys? Is it the movement of the turkeys making a mess, or is it they're messing up your idea of what your yard should look like? So either way, it's still you're involved in movement. But here's the point. What are the turkeys moving through? Could the turkeys move if there wasn't stillness? I don't know how to say this to you. Did you know that I'm picking a figure. I'll ask a question first. Which is greater? That which is still or that which moves? Because there can't be movement without stillness, can there? You have to have stillness to have movement. You don't have to have movement to have stillness. I'm asking you to see it. Yes. Movement comes out of stillness, therefore stillness is greater than movement. Did it ever occur to you that 95% of your life you don't see? Because that's the fact. You don't see. You see the turkeys. That's including when you're out with your family. Oh, I just love that. And you don't even understand that the things you see that irritate you couldn't irritate you without your being that irritation. That you can't have that negative state that you experience around another human being unless the potential for that negative state exists inside of you, stirred only by a condition perceived as being outside of you. And the condition persists and persists and persists. Why? Because part of that condition and part of that movement is to do what? It's to generate in that same mind what to do about that, what to think towards people who do those things. How to get beyond what it is that just bothered you so you never have to be bothered again. So movement gives birth to movement, gives birth to movement, and everything that's produced in that movement is what? A way in which to find security, which is upstream. And here's security upstream. Here it comes. Wait. Oh, no. Which is greater, the movement of the river or the river itself? Which is greater, the yard that the turkeys run through or the turkeys that run through it? Most of life is actually still, even though everything's moving. I understand at the atomic quantum levels, all that business. I'm just saying to you that the task that we have as human beings, if we're going to, and I get back to this, if we're going to have awakened in us that being which is beatific, that being which is godly, that being which has compassion in it, not as an act, but as the essence of itself. If we're going to have moving in us, I use that word carefully, love, that is not a love born out of me trying to get something or do something in order to be something, but a love that is the act of love itself, just as beauty seen makes beauty in the being. If that's going to happen, then we have to be able to begin to see the world in which that being already exists. Because to see it is to begin to participate in it in you. Stillness, the idea of it, is so essential because, for instance, when one meditates, most of people here anyway, I know you have somewhat of a meditative life. You know, the significance of a meditative life isn't necessarily the sense of quiet that comes out of it. But as a person begins to see, the interior silence in themselves, they begin to receive the peace that is inherent in that silence. They're not different states. And when that silence that sits inside of a human being as the foundation, if you will, of that man or woman, of this life, as that becomes more and more perceived directly by an individual, guess what else starts to happen? Then he doesn't have to think to himself anymore, how should I treat this person that I'm standing here with? Why? Because I see the river and the movement. I see the whole of the river, the stillness of the river. Do you understand the whole of anything is perfectly still? The whole of anything is perfectly still. So when I see the whole of something in that moment, even though I can participate in its movement, when I see the whole of something, lo and behold, I actually get to experience in that moment what I see. And what I see is the whole of that. So if I'm sitting with somebody And I'm not just, how many of you have ever been with somebody and they're negative, so you're negative? And when they're negative and you get negative, what do you usually do with your negativity? You blame it on them. And then you do what after that? More movement. More, let's punish them. Let's show them what's wrong with them. Let's tell them. How many of you explain to people what's wrong with them? Do you know that if you ever have to explain to another human being what's wrong with them, you couldn't be more wrong? You're compelled to talk. So, what's the alternative? And this is the whole point of the talk. I have to learn what it means to see stillness. Listen, but I can't see stillness that I'm not aware of. I can't see stillness that I'm not aware of. So as I'm talking to you and I see pens writing and heads moving, nodding or whatever, nodding both yes and both falling asleep apparently, that in order to be aware of stillness, there has to be all of this movement going on and at the same time the awareness of the stillness, the whole of the room. See, so you see how many understand that? When you see a river, when you see turkeys, when you see anything, all you see is the object and its movement. When you see someone you like or don't like, all you see is the object and the movement that that produces. You never see the whole of the field in which that is taking place. And that's what awareness is. Awareness is a receptivity to the whole of something that includes movement, instead of your present awareness being defined by the movement. And it's a work. It's a genuine work. One has to understand what we've spoken about. See the fact of it. Recognize the inherent things right inside of everything we've said. And then realize, you know what? Here I am. I'm going to go into my day again. And I can guarantee this before I've even finished speaking. Your mind is already moving through your day. There's already plans. There's all I got to do. And there's nothing sweet in it. There's just the empty promise of another thought pursuing a promise for the purpose of ending the pain that that thought started in the first place. That's all there is. And to see that is only possible when you're there and you see the whole of the picture. You're not just captured in the movement of the river. But do you know what has to happen? One has to step back, doesn't one? The father had to take the daughter to the top of the mountain, spiritually speaking, and show her that the movement of the river is only a small part of it. And that the reason there's pain in her life is because all she does is watch the movement and identify with what's coming and what's going. That's the mind and its own thoughts unconscious to itself. That's the mind and its thoughts unconscious to itself. But in that same being of that human, in that same little girl, in you and I, exists a completely different order of nature. A completely different energy, a completely different self that does not need to see anything moving in order to have the sense of itself as being well. It takes what it is, not by thinking towards the world it sees, but by allowing the whole that it sees to define the whole of it with whatever it may be that that whole contains, and it's an intelligent whole. In that stillness, in that compassion that I'm talking about that is one and the same, it never thinks about what it means to be a compassionate person. The intelligence itself is in the stillness. You must think on these things. You must work at what I've talked about and begin the practice, if you will, however you want to go about it, of learning to start looking and letting the movement be there, but seeing the stillness that that movement goes through. If you work at that and work at that, you'll begin to live in a completely different world in which all that you've been searching for is part and parcel with it.
Hello, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. You've been listening to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley. To learn more about Guy Finley and his nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation, visit guyfinley.com, where you'll find a host of free, life-changing information. Thanks for joining us today.
Love, the brightest and most powerful force in the universe. Love melts stress and cancels resentment. It gives birth to kindness and is the fuel of success. Love is at the heart of every great relationship and is the true essence of lasting peace. In his new book, Apprentice of the Heart, best-selling author Guy Finley explores lessons in life only love can teach. This breakthrough book contains the tools you need to strengthen and deepen all of your relationships with family, friends, coworkers, and with the present moment itself. Apprentice of the Heart, available now at GuyFinley.com and fine bookstores everywhere. Joseph Polansky of Diamond Fire magazine writes, "The reader is lifted up to a whole new realm, a rarefied region of the soul." To order your copy of Guy Finley's Apprentice of the Heart, visit GuyFinley.com. That's GuyFinley.com. The relationship your heart longs for already exists.